This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington School Superintendent Barry Riley says there's a lot of new energy in District 87, partly because there are a lot of new teachers.
There's been some changes at State Farm that has led to some attrition. In many occasions, you'll have trailing spouses, some of whom will be teachers.
More on the State Farm effect on District 87 and the start of the new school year with Eric Stock. Plus, the early political trends just after statehood in Illinois still linger today. Illinois Wesleyan University political scientist Jim Simeone talks about independent producerism. A new food pantry targets one segment of the community that might not have access to nutritious foods. Some Illinois State University students. Ryan Denham reports. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois' new Invest in Kids program has helped pay tuition for some students to attend private schools in Bloomington and throughout the state this year. But as GLT's Eric Stock reports, the program has long-term impact, and that remains unclear.
Advocates of school choice have praised the program. It covers between 50 and 100% tuition for students to attend private schools in Illinois. The program is paid for by donations, which provide a 75% deduction on state taxes. The state legislature approved the program and capped it at $75 million. Investing Kids enjoyed widespread popularity at the start. When it was rolled out in January, it received so many online applications, it crashed the system within minutes. According to a report from WBEZ Radio, granting organizations have awarded more than 5,600 scholarships, totaling $42 million. The state received more than 53,000 applications, meaning about 10% of applicants received some financial assistance. Jamie Hartrick, principal of St. Mary's School in Bloomington, says the scholarship tax credit program will help as many as 18 students attend school there this year. She says 15 students have been awarded full need-based scholarships through Empower Illinois, the largest provider, while two other scholarships are still pending and an additional student is getting a partial scholarship.
I didn't know what to expect because I didn't know what the outpour would be from our community, but as soon as they heard about it, it was a huge success. Our parish really values Catholic education, and it just proved that point that it was well needed.
Hartrick says the K-8 school attracted three new students through the program. They are now able to afford the annual $7,400 tuition bill. She adds parents of 36 students applied for the scholarship. She says donors contributed $137,000 to the school, leaving about $124,000 for scholarships after Empower Illinois took its cut. Central Catholic High School in Bloomington has given one scholarship through the program and possibly two additional partial scholarships, Principal Sean Foster.
There were actually a lot more people who applied that wanted to receive that tuition assistance than assistance was available. So that tax scholarship program really did help us, and we're very interested in seeing that continue to grow.
Central Catholic received $16,000 in donations through the Empower Illinois program. Epiphany Catholic School in Normal received close to $15,000 through Empower Illinois. Epiphany principal Michael Luton says the funds provided scholarships for a family of three students who had previously been homeschooled but were members of their church parish, and a sixth grader who had already been enrolled at Epiphany. Luton says families of more than 40 students and prospective students had applied for the scholarships. Not all private schools immediately jumped on board the Invest in Kids program in year one. Officials at Trinity Lutheran School in Bloomington decided to wait a year to see how scholarships are distributed before encouraging parents to donate to the program. Principal Sean Hoffman.
So before we ask our donors to start moving to that direction and donating in a separate spot, we were unsure if those dollars would even come back to the school or if only portions of those dollars come back based upon a different setting of guidelines.
Empower Illinois' Policy Director Joshua Dwyer says donors may request their money pay for scholarships at the school of their choice. Funds not earmarked for a specific school are divided among five regions of the state: Cook County, the Northern Counties, North Central Counties, and Central and Southern Counties. Dwyer adds, as of August 6th, Empower Illinois awarded scholarships totaling $122,000 to students in four McLean County schools. It appears a bulk of that went to students at St. Mary's. Investing kids has caused concern for some public school educators who liken it to a voucher system that will cause some cash-strapped public schools to struggle further as students use public dollars to fund their private school education. District 87 Superintendent Barry Riley says he doesn't believe the private scholarships will dent enrollment at McLean County public schools.
I just don't think that that'll have much of an impact on not just us, but others in this community. I just think that because the schools are really good in this county.
While most private school officials will be interviewed for the story say they're grateful for what Investing Kids offers, they add it's just a fraction of the financial assistance they offer to help students from low-income families attend. I'm Eric Stock.
Invest in Kids sunsets in 5 years unless state lawmakers move to extend it. Democratic candidate for Governor J.B. Pritzker has said he would kill the program if elected.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, dedicated to providing comprehensive, community-based cancer care in Bloomington Normal. The center gives patients hope through state-of-the-art technology and caring support services. Details at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a look at the start of the school year in District 87 and Unit 5, and an interview with Superintendent Barry Riley, conducted by Eric Stock. Illinois State University students are starting their second week of classes today. By now, they have a place to stay, a bag full of books, and a jam-packed schedule of classes, work, and student clubs. One thing that may be missing is access to nutritious food. The new School Street Food Pantry helps to fix that. It opens next month inside the Normal First United Methodist Church right next to ISU. GLT's Ryan Denham sat down with four of the organizers, Normal Township Supervisor Sarah Grammer, Reverend Kim Burke from the church, and ISU students Gina Campbell and Noah Tang. Campbell says the data on food insecurity among college students is clear.
One of those studies basically brought together all the current research. So in that, they did an analysis, and they came to find that about 45% of students nationally are facing some version of food insecurity. So that either means that they are very food insecure or food insecure according to the U.S. standard of food insecurity.
And what about data related to ISU? Do you have any sense of whether or not that 45% figure or something close to it exists here on our campus?
Yes. So our statistics are very similar. So we have three different studies that happened on campus. One of them is an IRB-approved study, so that means it went through the Institutional Review Board, and that's in preparation for publication. That study indicated 40% of students are food insecure. So in that study, there were a few different requirements, and they are looking at a few different things, which is... But some of those questions were comparable to the ones that we utilized in later studies. So there was a survey done by myself and Noah and another student that indicated about 45% were food insecure. And then there was also a study done by the student government spring 2017. And some of their questions, one of their questions was, do you know other students that are experiencing food insecurity? And over 60% of students indicated that they knew somebody that was experiencing food insecurity. So the statistics are very similar to the national statistics.
So you talked early on about being in a food desert here at ISU on this campus. This seems kind of counterintuitive. You think of this campus and its size, and we're right near Uptown, but in reality, if you really think about whether or not there's an affordable grocery store right nearby, there's really not. Can you get into that one level deeper?
When people say, oh, students can just take the bus to get groceries, they don't understand that you have to actually get on the bus, you have to look at all the bus schedules, you have to seriously consider the amount of food that they have to bring back to their apartments, holding all their bags, and the amount of time that just takes out of their day. So what a lot of college students are right now is considered time impoverished as well, which means they just don't have enough time in their days because of all their very, very intense schedules with classes and such to go out and get those food supplies.
So I wonder if you can describe what type of ISU students will be coming here. I don't know who you can picture in your head, but if you can try to describe them, is it graduate students? Is it international students? Is it first-year students? I mean, what kind of people are you going to be?
So in order to live in the dorms, you kind of have to have a meal plan. So this is more geared towards students who live off campus, who don't necessarily have the money for meal plans, and graduate students and international students, but we're not going to turn away students because they're in the dorms. If they desire a need for food, we shall give it to them. Also, another very, very important demographic might be student athletes. Because of NCAA rules, they're not allowed to work outside of their sports, so they're not actually going to have time to make their own money to buy food as well. And that also means they're time impoverished, so they can't go get their food as on just like other students.
Kim Burke, minister here at Normal First United Methodist Church. Who else can use the pantry?
And while this is for Illinois State students, this is designed for college students. So that might also be Illinois Wesleyan. That could be Heartland Community College. There are other college students in the area. And I think particularly those community college students are ones that would be like Gina was talking about, that may have dependents or that may be among those who we would consider like the working poor.
Gina Campbell, does this surprise people that food insecurity is such a problem on a college campus like this?
It does surprise people. And having personal experience with that, when their surprise always shocks me. I'm type 1 diabetic, so coming into school is a burden. I have medical bills, and my jobs previous, I was working basically at poverty wage. So having limited resources before entering university, I didn't get more resources all of a sudden coming into school. I appreciated the opportunity to come to education, but I also didn't have a lot of support in terms of access to food. So there are a lot of resources. There are a lot of resources on campus, but there isn't necessarily a specific location for students who are food insecure to relay those insecurities or to relay that they didn't have access to food. So it's definitely something that can be easily overlooked, and I think a lot of people, there are assumptions that are being made that aren't necessarily representative of the population that is attending university.
What does it say about the state of higher education that there needs to be a food pantry next door to it?
I know I've gotten a lot of comments from older people saying, like, oh, you're college students. When I was in college, I could just work and get food. But they don't realize that the cost of college since they've gone to school and the cost of living in general has skyrocketed. And the wages hasn't really, for minimum wage, the buying power hasn't really increased since the 1970s. So having all of that being crushed onto students at once is insane.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm standing in the new School Street Food Pantry next to ISU. The pantry opens next month. I'm sitting down with four of the organizers who put this thing together. Sarah Grammer, Normal Township Supervisor, let me ask you a question. How did this come together?
My interest started last fall. I'm the Normal Township Supervisor, and part of my job is to administer assistance to people in the community who are experiencing financial hardships. And towards the end of last fall semester, I had a number of college students who came in the office who were struggling to get through the end of the semester. They were already so invested, and they had just a few weeks left to get through finals, but were struggling with possibly losing their apartments. I remember a couple people in particular had already had their electricity shut off and had been trying to maintain their school schedule without electricity to their apartment. And food wasn't even talked about. And yet I could tell they were very, very hungry on top of the other structural things that they were trying to maintain. There are actually no food pantries currently open in the area on Fridays, for example. Most of them are weekday mornings during the time that a lot of students are in school. So I recognized a gap.
So, Sarah, you connect with a minister here at Normal First United Methodist Church at a Christmas party. Then around the same time, you also connect with Jeannie Campbell through one of her ISU professors. Gina, what happens next?
One of my courses is specific to organizations and community practice. So at that time, my professor had brought up that Sarah was working to address food insecurity on campus, and I started to do research on food insecurity, looking at the national statistics, and then started to reach out into the local community and with different student groups to find out what was happening on campus. Is this something that reflects what's happening on campus? Is this an issue? And to kind of bulk up the evidence and to really get a picture of what was going on. And at the same time, Noah, we had all been working on this issue at the same time, but weren't necessarily connected yet. And then Noah and I met.
Yeah, actually, I got into this food pantry on kind of two converging fronts. I took a class last semester with Dr. Miranda Lynn called Service Learning. It was an honors engagement class for my honors degree. And my semester project for that class was to kind of look at the demographics in the community and kind of figure out what is the best way to go forward with something like this. And I'm like, we need a food pantry on Illinois State University. We just need it. That's going to answer a lot of problems. So that's one part. And the other part is I am part of the Bloomington Normal Democratic Socialists of America, which is a chapter kind of organizing around these issues of food insecurity and labor issues, things like that.
So, Pastor Kim, why was this something that you wanted to have in your church?
We have been aware of the issue of food insecurity, and we also are very aware of where we sit geographically and want to be good neighbors with ISU and with college students. We have a college ministry that we share space with here in our building, and so we're kind of aware of those issues as well. And so we are aware that, you know, we have some of the space and we can partner with. It just seems like a great fit of being able to reach out to be good neighbors, to share that space with others. So we feel very fortunate and privileged to be able to do that and come together in that way.
Well, what kinds of things will be in this room come September 21st?
There's a few different things that we would like to supply and to help students with. Basic level, what is going to be in this room? We are looking to supply fresh veggies, fruits, produce is something that is indicated by students as a need in one of the surveys that we completed. U of I Extension Office provides a list that specifies what makes a food pantry healthy also. And they say that produce, meats, proteins, so soy burgers, etc., and then also vitamin D-rich products such as milks. And then we're also looking to provide some different courses. So not only just those materials, and also toiletries, I forgot to mention that. We're going to be providing budgeting courses, cooking classes, and then also courses on how to apply for SNAP so that students can, get get on their feet.
So Noah, at this point in the process, you're several weeks away from opening the pantry. What do you need right now? What could the public do to help you guys get this thing up and going?
We are in need of volunteers to help us set up. We need volunteers to help kind of bring in the food basically on regular shipment days. We need people to man the stations to kind of help people get the food. And we also need people to donate things like non-perishable foods and especially if you have cookbooks at home that you do not use, we're thinking of starting a little cookbook library for students to have because I know a lot of people have them just lying around and college students could use them because we're going to, as a part of the mission of the food pantry, we want to help students learn how to cook as well, just not give them ramen and let them go. So yeah, we also accept monetary donations.
Those can be dropped off at the church between 8 and 4, and that can be dropped off at the office.
And if anyone wants to go see, you can go to www.schoolstreetfoodpantry.org, and that has a whole bunch of information and resources on it for people who might want to volunteer as well.
That's GLT's Ryan Denham speaking with ISU student Noah Tang and the other organizers of the new School Street Food Pantry. Starting September 21st, the pantry will be open from 4 to 6 p.m. every Friday.
Hey there, I'm Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A. We are excited to join the lineup at GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media. On 1A, we cover serious news.
The short of it is, war is bad for you. It's bad for everyone who goes.
And while we take the program seriously, it doesn't mean we don't have time for the awesome.
Hello, Joshua. Welcome to the International Space Station.
Explore politics, technology, and more with time for the serious and the awesome. 1A, starting Monday, September 10th on GLT.
Support for GLT comes from the Illinois Prairie Community Foundation, raising financial resources to increase the independence and dignity of women and girls in our community. More information about the Women to Women Giving Circle and more at ilprairiecf.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois settlement patterns did a lot to shape the early politics of the state and remain a force today, according to Illinois Wesleyan University political scientist Jim Simeone. Illinois was settled partly from the South in the Upland Southern Movement as people came north along the Mississippi River and up from Kentucky. Later waves came from the East and even from the North down from the Great Lakes as Canada and the Yankee East contributed people to the Illinois country. Simeone talks with GLT ahead of a presentation at the McLean County Museum of History tomorrow about the way settlement informed the politics.
Until about 1830, the vast majority of the people were from the Upland South. So it was not necessarily a slave state, but it was a state with slaves. And it was a state with people who thought as Southerners. The vast majority of the population were from Kentucky and Georgia and Tennessee.
How much tension did that create in the 1830s as slavery began to become a really touch point issue for the national political scene?
That's a good way of putting it because, in fact, before 1820, we didn't have a lot of national conversations about slavery until the Missouri Compromise sort of opened the cork and changed the narrative nationally. There weren't very many pro-slavery advocates. So, yes, in a sense, that period between 1820 and 1830 was a crucial changing part nationally, and Illinois played a part in that. In that, Illinois did have the effort to turn the state into a slave state in 1822-1823, the famous convention controversy. And in August of 1824, the state voted, you know, something like 6,500 to 5,900 to stay free.
That's a pretty close vote.
Exactly. And so a lot of these Southerners were anti-slavery. They left the South precisely to move away from slavery. However, economically, it was difficult for the state to make it without extra hands, extra labor. And that's a big part of the story of Frontier Illinois, is how hard it is to, you know, get clear of the land office, to be a farmer who settles and is actually able to purchase land that perhaps they've squatted on. So part of the movement to bring slaves into the state was that Missouri in 1820 becomes a state, and all the settlers start going to Missouri. And the Illinois people are saying, well, gee, we would like to capture some of that emigration. And if we allowed people to have some what they call limited slavery rights, we'd be able to capture that immigration, and then that would allow the markets in Illinois to grow, and we could sell our surplus corn, and that's how we would be able to pay for our land.
It's kind of a devil's bargain, though, because once you plunk down the capital investment for a slave, then you have to recoup that investment in either producing corn or you produce more saleable people. And a lot of Southern slave owners were in hock up to their eyeballs and had to produce a surplus of slaves so that they could make their debt service payments. In Illinois, it's a little different because of the labor shortage, as you said, but how did the economics of slavery affect Illinois in that sense?
Your observation is astute, especially for states like Maryland and Virginia, where a lot of Illinoisans came from, because those lands had been, if you will, worn out by the plantation system. And those states had become, you know, net producers of slaves, selling their slaves to other states, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas. So, yes, but of course, in the case of Illinois, you'd have to change your entire constitution because it came in as a free state. And that was another contentious issue in the 1818 Constitution. Many of the settlers felt that they would have liked more slavery rights, but they couldn't get it past Congress. And that sort of feeds into this egalitarian culture that they had, where they are the outsider group. They are the poor white farmer who needs to make it, you know, clear their land out of the land office, and the whole world is put upon them. So they basically are struggling, and they're looking for whatever policy they can to make it. And you have to remember too that there were some special exceptions. The French had been in Illinois for over a century, and they had slavery. The Salines down in Gallatin County were allowed to bring in indentured servants for 1 year at a time. So there were also slaves brought into the state that way. And in addition, those coming from the South could, under the 1818 Constitution, indenture their slaves with the county supervisor. And often those indentures went for 50, 60, 70, even 99 years we have record of. So there was a sort of de facto slavery in Illinois, and they were happy with that balance. But what happened is then starting in the 1820s, some Yankees started coming in, some English started coming in, and they were adamantly anti-slavery. The other group that was very strong anti-slavery were the Methodists. You start getting some fear among the more pro-slavery settlers that their way of doing things that they had been doing since 1809 when Illinois became a territory would be changed. And that's where the convention controversy came in.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. I'm talking with Jim Simeone of Illinois Wesleyan University, who's giving a talk at the McLean County Museum of History about Illinois and its development as part of the bicentennial celebration. That'll happen Tuesday, August 28th. You talked about egalitarianism and the state of Illinois. Is really, though, the idea of the independent producer something of a myth?
Certainly, it is a story that the politicians would tell the people, and the people would accept it and understand it. But it was a device used to garner votes. What's so interesting, however, is that both the Democrats and the Whigs bought into this story. The other thing I would say, Charlie, is this word egalitarian is one that needs to be clarified and
unpack it then.
Unpacked, right? Because we generally think of it, I would say, in a horizontal dimension, equality among individuals on a level playing field. But egalitarianism also had a vertical dimension, and it had a group dimension. So the group that you were a part of, in this case, the poor white settler, saw itself arrayed vertically in a hierarchy with other peoples, other groups. Certainly in Illinois, the big folk, the wealthy, were considered above the white folks, above the poor white settler. There was a sense that if we were going to have democracy, it should be for the downtrodden. It should be for the group that's been put upon by the world. And so while there was equality at the horizontal level, there was also this vertical dimension, which was very important in politics. And so what the Jacksonian Democrats would point out is that the Whigs weren't really for the group that of the downtrodden, for the poor. They were for the bankers. They were for the manufacturers, the people who wanted to bring in tariffs, which, of course, would make goods that the farmers buy more expensive.
They were for the old settlers who already had their land.
That is a good, an interesting way of putting it. I would call that a cross-cutting interest.
Okay.
Such that you have a lot of Whigs adopting the settler narrative and saying, yes, we are the settlers too. You know, in fact, I have a great line here from a newspaper in Chicago in 1838. And they're saying, settlers, free men, citizens of Illinois, will you vote for one who will drive you away from your farms and claims? Answer on the 1st of August. Vote against Martin Van Buren, who stigmatizes you as trespassers and intruders. So the Whigs were adopting this populist rhetoric of the squatter and the settler in Illinois, which is ironic because they were always being painted as the group who endorsed the wealthy. And so here they decide, I'm going to play the game of the Jacksonians. I'm going to follow the rules of the independent producer narrative, and I'm going to buy into it, and I'm going to say I'm the advocate of the independent producer. And by the way, this, of course, is Abraham Lincoln's version of the Whig Party, which was much more open and inclusive than the old Whig Party, or maybe even worse, the National Republicans, who were, in fact, very elitist.
Politics really doesn't change. It's always co-opting the other side's rhetoric for your own vote mobilization.
Yes.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Jim Simeone is giving a talk as part of the Bicentennial Observances in the state of Illinois Tuesday at the McLean County Museum of History. So let's expand on how Illinois became Jacksonian.
That is an interesting story in itself. The party system, the two-party system, really didn't get entrenched in Illinois until the late 1830s. And it's really fascinating. How did it happen? Basically, how it happens just about any place that a party works. You need people to get out the vote. You need people to talk up your points, talk up your candidates, visit with their neighbors. And those people either knew someone who had been hired in a job or were themselves hired in a job, right? And so that transactional side of politics was very important. And it's remarkable to see how efficient it was. So, for example, if you look at the poll records in Illinois in the 1820 through 1835 period, people are voting all over the place. You know, they might vote for a Whiggish person for governor, but they end up voting for a Democratish person in the General Assembly. And there's But by 1835, 1836, the poll books changed dramatically, and suddenly everyone is voting party line. And this is because the operatives are out in the field handing out basically the party ballot, and the voters are following the party ballot.
How much of that is also tied to growth in the patronage system through the Postal Service? I mean, the Postmaster General was like the second most powerful cabinet person in that era at the national level, and that was because he had a patronage army with each post office. As Illinois became more settled, there were more post offices, more patronage to hand out.
So that's referring to, as well, the federal layer. And that's why it took so long in Illinois. By the time you get to the 1830s and later, you have a lot more development. You have a lot more land offices opening up. You have a lot more post offices.
So did that also contribute to the polarization of everybody voting party line?
Yes, it did. I mean, there was an ideological component, but then there was also this transactional sort of jobs component, if you will. It's just that the federal government wasn't as big as you think. They were sort of the icing on the cake. And without a doubt, there were these networks and coalitions of U.S. senators and then state politicians. But the truth is, the federal level was less influential at that point. It is true, we tell the story of Abraham Lincoln getting his first postal appointment from, you know, Andrew Jackson. So that was in, I think, 1834 or 35. So it did happen that you got appointments from people. But, you know, there's also a famous story of Illinois being Van Burenized in 1827. And that was basically where Elias Kent Kane, the U.S. senator, who was an ally of Van Buren, began to build, to make ties to the factions within Illinois. And they began to build a network. And I would say, though, that that network was as ideological and revolved around the narrative of the independent producer as much as it was transactional, dealing with did you get a job or not.
How has independent producerism continued as a theme in our politics even today?
I think you see it in our many people's reaction to the Affordable Care Act. People, when I would finally, you know, try to get them to explain to me why they were so opposed to it, in many cases, it was the fear of dependency on the state. You know, ultimately, it was basically people were going to lose their independence. And they would not be ultimately producers anymore. They would become dependent on the state. Now, you can argue that, in fact, perhaps providing opportunities for healthcare separate from a job would allow someone to leave their place of employment and try, take a risk and try a new opportunity. And you can talk about it that way, but that was never very persuasive. And I think in part because of this old tradition of the independent producer and the fear of dependency, of becoming dependent on the state. You just don't see the state as providing opportunities for independence. They think of it only as a device for creating dependency.
Professor Jim Simeone teaches political theory and law at Illinois Wesleyan University. He speaks tomorrow evening at 7 at the McLean County Museum of History on how frontier Illinois became the land of the independent producer and why it matters today. He's the author of Bottomland Republic, Democracy and Slavery in Frontier Illinois. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You're listening to Bloomington Normal's Public Media. Still to come, a look back at the Springfield race riots 110 years ago this month. The head of the Bloomington Public School System says new facilities and a bunch of new people have infused District 87 with energy he hasn't seen before in his three-decade career. But Superintendent Barry Riley acknowledges in this conversation with GLT's Eric Stock, the district will face its share of challenges.
We have a lot of new staff members this year, and I think the number is about 75, and that's a huge number. So you take into account you have that new group coming into the district, that brings an energy all by itself. I also think that we've had some change in some leadership positions. I always feel that when that occurs, you want to take that and raise it to another level. I felt like when I came to this district, Bob Nielsen, who was a superintendent before me, put the ball on the tee and made it easy for me to take it from there. And I think people like Cindy Helmers, Christina Lammers, Cindy was in the assistant superintendent role. Christina was a leader at Irving. We've had new people come into those positions, and they set it up really well for these folks to really take it and make it their own. And I think you add all those things together. We had a wonderful STEM camp that was about a week before regular school started. And you add it all together, and it just made for a phenomenal start to the school year.
75 new staff, mostly teachers. Is that more than usual?
It is more than usual. Usually we might have about 30, and we had about 50 new teachers this year.
Why so many?
Well, it's sometimes those will ebb and flow. It just depends on you know, your retirements that you have. There could be, and I haven't analyzed this yet, but everyone knows that there's been some changes at State Farm that has led to some attrition out to the various hubs. And in many occasions, you'll have trailing spouses, some of whom will be teachers. So that will be one component of that. It's not the only factor, but obviously that can contribute to that. But some other things that add to the positive vibe, stepping away from that for a moment and going back to that, that I didn't mention, are the new facilities that we've got, or the remodel facilities. We've got some great things happening at the high school with the new band room addition. We have remodeled the orchestra room for the choir and remodeled the what was the band room for the orchestra. And we've added some additional spaces for the BACC, for our technology folks. Those spaces have turned out great and really work well for the programs, but also look really good. I can tell you that I was at an event recently at the high school when I had a young man come up to me out of the blue and just thank me. He was near tears, and this is a kid who's a senior who is in the choir and is in the band, could not believe what this Board of Education and what this district did for him and his peers in terms of creating those spaces for them. And that, to me, just made it all worthwhile. I really commend the board for allowing us to do this, and really it signals to the community a strong value for the fine arts, for sure. But more importantly, I think it just it shows how much we value education and education of our kids. And it's really important to us because that's a pretty significant investment into those programs and into these kids. But the research tells us it's really good for kids. And so we're excited that it's here, and that has added to the positive vibe as we start the year.
They were in an incredibly tight space before the renovation. Do you have room for additional students to join the fine arts programs?
Sure, we do. Now, obviously, you know, at some point that could, if it grew significantly, that could create space issues. I'd welcome that problem, quite frankly, because, again, I know the good things that it does for kids socially, academically, emotionally. It, you know, there was a time when I was in school, this is many, many years ago, where it wasn't cool to be in the band or the orchestra. I can tell you that that is absolutely not the case today, certainly not at Bloomington High School. I would love to have all kids be a part of one of those programs, if not more. For a lot of reasons, but mainly because we know it's good for them, and it just helps them be successful. So the more the merrier. Yes, there is capacity for more, but I'd welcome a problem of there's so much growth that we'd have to look at what are we going to do now. I don't anticipate that for a while, but that'd be a great problem to have.
This is Sound Ideas. Eric Stock with Barry Riley, District 87 Superintendent. Going back to filling the teaching positions, you had more than usual this year for various reasons, but as we have reported on in recent weeks, there is a teaching shortage across the state and across the country. How difficult was that to fill a larger number of positions than usual with what, by all evidence, is a smaller teacher pool than there has been in the past?
I don't think it was extremely challenging for us, albeit for a few positions that are always difficult to fill. That is nothing new for any district that's out there. We have an advantage over most in that we are in a desirable community. We pay well for our teachers, and we have good benefits, and we have great support here for them as classroom teachers. So, and you have your universities in your backyard to advance in your education if you want to. There's tuition waivers that are applied to Illinois State University that they can use. So there's a lot of positives that are entailed in coming to District 87. So it's the pool may be shrinking and there may be fewer, but we still get a fairly good number of candidates for most positions.
Substitutes seem to be in even greater demand, and the pay for them is not particularly good here or anywhere. Do you see that situation continuing to get worse, and then are there ways to remedy that?
Well, it could. My hope is that it doesn't get any worse. when you have low unemployment rates, then that can make it even a little tougher, which we were in a time where that's occurring. I think the things that make it more attractive or non-monetary, obviously they'd love to have more money, but when that's not an option, the things that make it more attractive are how they're valued as people, how well we treat them when they come. Are we prepared? Do we help them be prepared? Do we support them? And I can tell you that Herschel Hannah, my assistant for HR, does a lot of work behind the scenes, and he does a lot of professional development with the substitute teachers, offers those supports, really works with our building principals to make sure that that's happening in the buildings and that substitutes are treated very well.
And looking lastly at the enrollment numbers for District 87 to start this year, it is early, of course. The numbers a little bit behind last year's pace, and most of it at the junior high level. Is it too soon to glean anything from those numbers at this point, a week into the school year?
Yeah, it is, only because we haven't had an opportunity to really dive into that and look. I think on the surface, what we had was a very large eighth grade group that comes into the high school this year as freshmen, and a senior class that was, I wouldn't say it was small, but the freshman class coming in is much larger than the senior class that left. So that has probably put the jump at the high school, and as well as the sixth grade incoming class is a little bit smaller. So you combine that large eighth grade group going out with a smaller sixth grade group coming in, that can give you the sense of why the junior high is down and also why the high school is up.
District 87, Superintendent Barry Riley with GLT's Eric Stock. Bloomington High School's biggest addition this year, the new Fine Arts Wing, was a $7.5 million project. It will be officially opened in a ribbon-cutting ceremony on September 13th. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The city of Springfield erupted in violence 110 years ago this month. A white mob set out to lynch two black men at the jail. When they found the men had been relocated, the mob attacked black neighborhoods, burning homes and forcing out black residents. The violence reshaped the city and led to the founding of the NAACP. Illinois Newsroom's Rachel Otwell tells us what the community is doing to remember and to raise awareness.
The Springfield race riot was briefly famous around the world for the simple reason that it was in Abraham Lincoln's hometown. It kind of exemplified how far we had sunk with race relations. In fact, the crowd actually yelled something like, "Abe Lincoln brought you in, we will drive you out."
That's James Lowen, Central Illinois native, nationally renowned historian, and author of the book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. During the riot, thousands of whites attacked black residents, destroying much of a black neighborhood. At least seven people died. The violence reshaped Springfield in ways felt even today, but many people don't know the story.
The question is, how do we get adults to realize that our children are not stupid and that just as we don't want to be lied to, neither do they?
A Springfield Schools spokesperson told me, "We currently do not have district-wide curriculum for the race riots of 1908, but it's not just kids who don't know the history." Leroy Jordan's worked for years to raise awareness of the violence a century ago. Jordan was one of the first African Americans on the local school board. He saw the district through a desegregation order in the 70s. We talk in a Baptist church on the east side of Springfield, where he's a longtime resident. It's a majority black and low-income area. Jordan says the people living here are still largely misunderstood. And as for the 1908 riot,
I think it was a massacre. It's been kept quiet for years and years and years, and I personally think that the truth needs to be told about it so that we don't repeat this craziness that's going on in our country even today.
In a way, this history was largely buried for decades. 4 years ago, archaeologists set out to see if any remains of the black-owned residences burned down by whites were under a parking lot that would be affected by construction on a nearby railroad. They uncovered foundations and artifacts, pieces of dishware, a toilet, clothing, and a cross. Jordan and others have called for the consecration of those building remains. Not far from those tracks is a busy intersection. One of the streets is called Reconciliation Way. The name came as part of citywide efforts a decade ago to reckon with the atrocities that happened in the riot, including two innocent black men being tortured and lynched. The city continues to take steps to commemorate the riot. Today, right by this intersection, city leaders are unveiling updated historical markers originally installed in the 90s. They're designed to be more visible, and they include quotes from both Obama and Lincoln.
We look at what happened in Charlottesville, Klansmen that took off their robes to say that we're gonna wear khakis and polos, but we still would carry our tiki torches. So we will let you black folks know that we will still burn you out.
That's Ken Page, a former president of the local NAACP chapter.
We look at how far we've come, but we also have to realize how far we still have yet to go.
It's still several years away, but the NAACP's current Illinois president is helping plan a new way to remember the riot. Teresa Haley says an interactive outdoor memorial slash museum is set to be built over the foundations of those burned down homes near the railroad. Haley says the project, a major undertaking, is slated to be finished by 2025. In the meantime, Haley says she and others will continue to unbury the past. She says it's all part of a larger goal to defeat racism. And she says there are two key ways to fight that battle.
One is to vote. Two is to talk and to educate people about it.
I'm Rachel Otwell, Illinois Newsroom.
Visitors will walk through informational panels and end at a sculpture based on the tree used to hang a man. There will also be a healing garden outside. The project will be done by 2025. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.